Version number 8939, Captain Ian Hamerton, Reel 13.
You were telling me about coming back to England on leave.
Yes, well, I must have come back on leave amongst the early, when it first started, which must have been just before Christmas, I think. I know that although I was thrilled to go home, I was not very thrilled to be coming back because I knew that sometime after Christmas we'd be involved in the Siegfried Line business. However, on we went, and the next thing we were involved with was the Siegfried Line, and we moved up through Holland, over the bridge at Grave, into Nijmegen, and we were put up in some barracks in the town, and we made preparations for the battle. I can remember being driven up in the scout car to Groesbeek, and at any rate to see roughly where the start line was. We had maps showing the minefields and various other things like that, and it was going to be a big push. Well, of course, the Siegfried Line has played such a big role in the army right from 1939, we're going to hang out our washing on the Siegfried Line, that it had assumed a rather special importance. I do know that several members of my troop, particularly the older members, 31-year-olds, were not at all keen to go on leave before that. They said they wouldn't be able to come, they wouldn't be able to bring themselves back. And some of them deliberately refused to go on leave for that reason. One or two did go, so they weren't in the normal crews for that operation, and this accounts for a slight swapping round amongst my troop and others, of course.
Did that cause any significant disruption?
No, I don't think so. It's just that one had one's own particular places in where one put one's kit and things like that, and it meant it was different in another tank. On the morning of the do, we were up, it must have been about 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, and I can remember cold bacon sandwiches. I hate cold bacon sandwiches, especially at that hour of the morning. And we moved up, that the whole Nijmegen was full of troops. I can remember seeing the guards. We had a briefing in the guards' headquarters, I remember, and they were our follow-up troops, the Guards Armoured Brigade. And we moved up, we passed the heavy machine gun units firing their pepper pot, and the Bofors, light anti-aircraft, firing the pepper pot. You know what that is, I expect. And we moved up into Groesbeek, did our final radio checks and everything there, and then the word go. And we started out, and I had I think I was leading that day. And as we came out from behind the farmhouse, where the start line was, we went slap into a whopping great hole in the ground. It was something to do with the farm. It wasn't the enemy defence. But it slowed us up, and we didn't want to. So I hopped out of my tank, and I got... at this time, instead of having a second sergeant, I had a young second lieutenant who'd just come out to us. It was a strange coincidence. He was Brian Hickey, And I'd known his father, who was a major in the 61st Training Regiment. His father was had been commissioned from as a warrant officer and had become a major. And I had his son, and he was very raw, very young, and he was my second sergeant, and this was his first action. So I turfed him out of his tank, and I took over his tank, and I got him to get mine out of the ditch, or whatever it was, the hole, and to follow up, which he did. But by now I got my sergeant crew was in front, and I was echeloned. We were doing a two tank width lane initially, and we set off down the downward slope, the forward slope, flailing away. We saw something move behind a haystack, and we brought both guns to bear on it and blasted the haystack to smithereens. It turned out to be some chickens. We had a report as we crossed the start line. I think this is what sort of set in some of the panic. As we crossed the start line, over the radio came SP at farm along the road, something. So we had our guns out to the right anyway, trying to watch for this thing. We didn't see anything, just the chickens. We flailed and flailed and flailed right up to the level crossing that crossed the road. That's the railway that runs from Clave right through. And that was our aiming point. We didn't touch a solitary mine. When we got up there, we could see some enemy in the trenches. They had some slit trenches there, with their hands up. And I called to Jeff Crew I can't remember the order this happened. We were waiting for we were expecting the guards armoured in their Churchills to follow us down. We reported that we got to our target, and that said they could come through, but they didn't budge. They didn't budge at all.
Why was that?
I don't know. They just wouldn't budge. So as they hadn't cleared my tank at that particular moment, I said, right, well, what we'll do, we'll flail back and make another lane back, as we didn't touch any mines. The best thing we can do is widen it, and it'll make it a lot easier. So I signalled to Jeff, but for some reason he couldn't receive me. So I got out of the tank and ran up to his and thumped on his lid, because he was closed, and he gingerly opened it. And I shouted at him that we were going to flail back again, which we started to do. Not to widen the gap we'd made, but another gap nearby. And again we flailed back and didn't touch a solitary mine. By this time, the guards had started moving. Three tanks had moved up and were covering them through the lane. The Germans in their slit trenches had their hands up still. I wasn't bothered about them, not my pigeon at all. We were making these lanes, which was the important thing. And the guards came through, and they got onto the road, and they went sailing through. They didn't blow up at all. Now, the troops on either side, the rest of B Squadron, by the way, this was one of the few occasions when more than one squadron was involved. The rest of B Squadron were on my left, and they all had terrible trouble from mines and from the very soft ground. And not all the lanes succeeded. And the same on the right-hand side, the other side of the road in the little village.
Perhaps the guards were waiting for them to finish, or waiting to see which
could have been
lane would be the most suitable.
Could have been, but mine led directly onto the road, you see. Anyway, that opened up. Now, when the... I'm going to jump on a bit here. After the war was over and the engineers had constructed a railway bridge over the Rhine, that was the line that it linked up with. And I came back on another leave, oh, a long, long time later, and you could still see the flailed path right up to that level crossing. Anyway, this was the start of the Reichswald offensive. And from then on, things got a bit hectic because we followed the guards along on call. They didn't come across any terribly stiff opposition, but we were ordered not to use the road because it was to be used for troops who were directly involved. So we were told to keep to the fields, which we did, and we got to a field on the way up to near Cranenburg, I think the name of the nearest village was, before Cleve. And we bogged down. It was so soft. And in fact, it took us a whole day to get the squadron, or the remains of the squadron, because a number of tanks had been knocked out on mines. It took us a whole day for those to be hauled through that field. And it was just an ordinary small-sized field. And the only vehicles that would get us through were the Guards Recovery Churchills. And we had to haul each tank through. There were some houses nearby. They demolished those. They used the rubble for filling in. But it was a terrible, terrible time, and we were up to our eyes in mud. You jump off the tank and sink up to your knees in it. It was as soft as that. And of course, flails bellied very easily with the weight on the front. Anyway, we got through there, and just in time, because very shortly after that, the Germans blew the Rhine dikes, and that the area flooded. And the water crept up and up and up, and eventually that railway was underwater, and so was the road. And wheeled vehicles, or most wheeled vehicles, were able to negotiate it, but only by navigating between the trees and posts that were banged in and things like that. I didn't see much of that myself because we were... By this time we were getting up near Cleve. As we got near to Cleve, we were on a hillside next to a wood, and I remember it snowed during the night, and we had heavy, very heavy snow, but it cleared away the next morning. But of course this added to the ground troubles. We didn't do any shooting. We were on call for this, that and t'other. We did hardly any flailing. And I can remember coming into Cleve, which was really just a big heap of rubble. And the road wound down through the centre of the town. I've been trying to find it on my visits since, and it's been impossible to find. I can remember there was a big... women's wear shop on the corner, more or less a heap of rubble, but some horrible British soldiers had got some of the tailor's dummies and had done some rather obscene things to them, put it like that. Anyway, we went down, crossed over the little river the other side, and we were quartered in some houses near the little river. And I remember there was a sugar factory nearby, and we were able to replenish our stocks of sugar. But whether it was that night or the night after, I can't remember, we got a call during the night to move immediately. The water's coming up. And in fact, by the time we actually got all our gear slung onto the tanks and the tanks moving, the water was well up over the bogey wheels, and we had to drive back over the little Bailey Bridge, which was itself underwater, and up onto the higher ground in Clave. The Germans had blown another section of the dike. That was a terrific scramble. The next morning, it could have been, we were parked alongside blown up houses and so on. We managed, or somebody managed to find some nice white tablecloths and some cutlery and so on, and we were having breakfast in style when Monty rode by in his car, and we all stood up and saluted him very gravely, and he saluted us back. Didn't stop to inquire about the other things. That's the only time I think I saw him in he was up on the reconnaissance. Well, from then on, we were under command of all sorts of people, mainly the Guards Armour Division. At one point, I was detached with half a squadron, two troops and one of the headquarter tanks. There, we were constantly on little pushes here and there in support of attacks along above Clave. It was horrible going. The fields were very soft. On one occasion, we were crossing a field. There was very little cover up there. There were open fields. And there was a hefty great crash, and a shell, an HE shell, hit my turret. It hit the gun mantlet. And the shock of it dropped me from where I was standing. One stood on a little round seat in a Sherman. Dropped me down onto the floor, leaving my helmet up at the top. It broke the chin strap, and I arrived on the floor in a tangle of wires for my mic and earphones. The driver had automatically put his foot down, but the ground was so soft, he was in first gear with the engine racing away, and of course that causes an enormous draft, which is not very pleasant, and adds to one's sort of panic. Anyway, I got myself out the top in time to hear an AP whiz by. We eventually crawled, and it was centuries, into the shelter of a block of trees by the farm. And there was a slight dip in the ground there, and we put the tanks in a sort of hull-down positions in this little hollow and waited for whatever was coming, but nothing came. The SP, or whatever it was, had fired a couple of shots and bumped off.
Did you see it?
No, didn't see it at all.
Have you no idea what sort of range it would have been?
Well, it must have been from another belt of trees, the other side of the field somewhere. So it could only have been a few hundred yards. That's what we thought at the time. Well, I had orders to remain where I was from the guards battalion commander. So I remained where I was, and it got darker and darker and darker, because this was March, so it was getting dark fairly early still. And I didn't fancy being stuck out there in the dark with just a few tanks and no infantry at all. We were told not to maintain wireless silence, so I couldn't call him up. Anyway, he had a lot on his plate. So I decided I would walk back to him, which I did, in the dark. And I thought it was prudent to whistle some well-known English tunes as I went. And I got challenged a number of times as I got near to where the guards were. There was some infantry holding some slit trenches. Anyway, I went a considerable distance. It must have been a couple of miles. And eventually I found the battalion commander eating a nice hot meal. And I said, what do you want me to do? So he said, oh, you can come back if you like. Well, it was just too dark. It was ridiculous. So I made my way back to the lads, and we stayed the night there, and we were okay. But we didn't see anything of the enemy. And then, moving on, I think it was the next day, I can't be sure of the order that this happened, whether this happened before or after that incident. I know that I was not in my own tank. I was in a headquarters tank with a strange crew. And we were passing alongside the wood where there were SS troops in the wood. We knew that. This is a similar line of trees to where this SP was probably had been. And I actually saw some enemy soldiers, because one very rarely did. And I gave the order to give them some machine gun fire, Browning fire, and the gun jammed. So I said, right, HE, can't fire, I haven't got a firing pin. And did my nut. He dropped it, and he couldn't find his spare. So I said, well, I used my Browning from the turret. But the other, called to the other tanks, and they covered the air. But, oh, there was hell's fire after that, this wretched gunner. They didn't give us any trouble. We continued with our movement alongside this wood. We didn't have to go into the wood, we had to go along the edge of it in the direction of the attack. In due course, after several days, weeks, I don't know how long it was, we arrived at a point where we were a salient towards, if I remember rightly, Zanten, which is on the bank of the Rhine. And we were in a bit of a salient, sticking forward. And we came up towards a sort of spur of a hill with a report of a tiger lurking round the far side. And at that point, it was getting dark, so we were told to halt. And we made the proper defensive layout. I don't think there were any infantry around. We're on our own. The next day, we remained on guard in each tank throughout the night. We stood to the whole night through. The next day, by the way, that tiger had already picked off quite a number of tanks. The next day, there was a good deal of activity in the wood over to our right, which was several hundred yards off, and we fired quite a bit of HE in that direction to discourage anybody coming out. I remember that it was a very hot day, that the farm that we were in was pretty demolished and had burnt, and there were a lot of dazed cattle about. I think I mentioned this in connection with a pistol and tried to put one out of its misery. But another incident there, I very much needed to relieve myself. And since there appeared to be a lull in whatever was happening, I decided to get out, and I left my radio op in charge of my tank, and I hopped out, and there was a nearby, a few 20-odd yards away, 25 yards away, in this little orchard by the farm, there was a trench. It must have been a German trench. So I got down in there, and it's a quite a business getting a tang suit off with your belt and braces and pistol and all the rest of it, and your trousers as well. I got in a nice hull-down position when there was a hell of a swish, and I was showered with earth from an AP which hit the parapet of this trench. I never got my trousers on so fast in all my life. Back to the tank, and we sprayed the area again and moved into a slightly less exposed position. Didn't have any more shots over.
Could you tell me a bit more about this action when you were going along the edge of a wood and the machine gun jammed? How far away from the edge of the wood were you?
I should think 100 yards.
And how deep inside the wood were the enemy?
They were right on. They were outside the wood, in the field between us. What they were doing there, I have no idea.
Were they just moving about, or were they in positions?
They were in positions, and then, because when we came along, they started to leave those positions, and we fired at them.
In which direction were they leaving the position?
Towards the wood.
So they were legging it into the wood?
They were legging it into the woods, yeah. I think they were a bit disturbed by the large number of tanks that were going along, because they were 8 or 9, I suppose.
Now, you mentioned it was a headquarters tank. How did a headquarters tank differ from an ordinary tank?
It had no flail. It was an ordinary gun tank.
When you went on your walk back to see the yes. Guards Battalion commander and then back to your own tanks, how did you navigate? How could you navigate if you're walking through darkness like that?
I used my innate bump of direction, which I'm blessed with, fortunately. I must have had a map. We always had maps. Very good ones too, which is something I haven't mentioned, except in connection with the landing in Normandy. I carried a compass, but whether I used it or not, I don't know. It was pretty dark.
I presume a map wouldn't be much use unless you could actually see the contours.
I wouldn't have been able to see it, no. Honestly, don't know. It was just my normal bump of direction.
You also mentioned when you were at the farm getting the tanks into what you call the proper defensive layout for an overnight stop.
Well, it was like an open lager. Well, it was very nearly a closed lager. We were pretty close to each other, but again, it was an all-night vigil, one man on duty from each tank.
And was everybody in the tanks?
Yes, yeah. We deemed that was the most comfortable way, safest way.
You say it was safe and comfortable. Did you then prefer to stay in the tanks if you were on an overnight stop or to...
Like that, yes. Because you didn't know who was coming. You were if you were in a trench, slit trench or something like that, you'd have to dismount something, and it was one could often see better from the turret than you could from the ground, depending on the terrain, of course.
It does seem a bit odd that you were ahead of the infantry on these occasions and they weren't ahead of you.